This is Retail Tech Podcast, your guide to the current state and future of commerce. From AI and connected retail to the tech reshaping how products are discovered and sold, we break it all down. Whether you're a brand retailer or tech builder, stay ahead with the insights that matter. Let's get started.
This episode is brought to you by Visional, the hybrid AI-powered personal shopping assistant that blends smart recommendations with real human support. Visional connects shoppers with real-time inventory and live video assistance, making it easier to buy from local stores. For retailers, it's a game-changer, helping capture more local sales by turning interest into action. Discover the future of local e-commerce. See how Visional works at getvisional.com.
Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. This is Darius Wasefi, and today I have a different conversation into more business. My guest is Chris Irwin. Excited to have you on, Chris.
Excited to be here, Darius.
Let's start with a brief bio on yourself and Rockwater.
So I'm Chris Irwin. I'm the founder of Rockwater, and we do M&A and strategy advisory for the creator economy and digital agencies. We have a very simple goal for our clients, which is to help them make faster data-based decisions to drive enterprise value, grow revenue, and bring new products and services to market. And so we work with a broad range of companies that fit within our business model, which I'll touch on in a moment, but we have three main service buckets. We do one, capital markets. So buy and sell side M&A and fundraising advisory. Two, market research and intelligence. We help our clients determine signal from noise. We track capital flows, investment activity, product partnerships, you name it. Third, go-to-market planning. So we help our clients understand what's their unique value prop, what are their peers doing, and how are they differentiating the market, how you build a plan is going to get buy-in from leaders and investors. And so that's our core advisory business. And we work with large studios and digital media publishers and influencer agencies and e-commerce businesses and like the whole gamut from every single continent around the world, right? As the overall creator economy is going global. And then on top of our advisory business, we also host live events, typically every month, where we bring executives and decision makers together because we believe in deals over handshakes, not Zooms. And we also put out a lot of content just to help people build better. So we have an M&A newsletter that we publish every Friday. We have a deal blog, and I put out a lot of content on LinkedIn based on our learnings from all the M&A activity and capital flows in the space. What we've realized in the space is, you know, executives need a lot of help and our team is capable of doing many different things. But I think we've learned that one, there's really no specialist M&A advisor dedicated to the creator economy industry. So we want to fill that void and we're really good at it. And we enjoy the work that we do and we have an incredible network. So I feel that we're starting to hone in more in our transaction related services.
Let's go back to the first time we spoke. It was like when the pandemic was starting and live stream commerce and shopping was really picking up. Maybe we can start talking about the ups and downs in that space.
So I remember when we first spoke, it was back in like the 2020 timeframe. I think that's where the conversation around live stream shopping in the US was really starting to gain steam. I think everyone was looking at the trends in China and the $100 billion industry that was there. And it's like, okay, are the macro themes and trends in consumer activity, are they going to start translating to the United States and Western markets? So then you started to see a lot of capital flows into the space. So like Pop Shop Live, I think raised like a seed or series A. There was others like Common Sold. I think a lot of the large social media incumbents like Facebook and YouTube were starting to launch more live stream initiatives, saw the same from retailers. And there was a lot of buzz and movement in the space. Whatnot was growing like crazy. But then I think like, look, for broader trends in the creator economy between the period of 2022 to 2024, I think there was a few things that happened. So one, the capital markets really pulled back in the space and there's a lot less investments. And I think a lot of the early live stream and social commerce businesses had a hard time getting product market fit, realizing that user acquisition was really expensive. Their cost structures were a bit upside down and some of the businesses were more solutions in search of problems. And I think just general consumer behavior didn't really match what we had seen in China and some of those other Asian countries. And so there was a lot of consolidation and some fire sales in the space. And I think a lot of the incumbent social media platforms and retailers pulled back a bit as well. But now, you know, you look at 2024 and particularly in the beginning of 2025, you're starting to see a lot more social commerce activity. So for example, we saw Whatnot do a really big raise. I think that valued them at least $1 billion earlier this year in the first quarter. I think that was at like over 200 million. Then also there's been a lot of growth in the affiliate marketing space. So Later bought Mavely for $250 million, where that's essentially an influencer marketing platform and social media management company buying an affiliate technology stack. You also saw ShopMy, I think, raise over 70 million at like a $410 million valuation. We saw Verb Technology, a live stream commerce platform, buy LiveComp for around 8 million. And so you're just starting to see a lot more deals and activity in the space. And I think also you see it from another side of the market, where we were doing some analysis of some recent social publisher deals and YouTube channels. I think of like Epic Gardening or Good Good Golf. Good Good Golf just raised, I think, around $45 million from Premier Sports Capital. The majority of their revenues are actually not from ad sales and partnerships, but from product sales. And I think that's the same theme for Epic Gardening as well. Started as like a blog and editorial business, moved into video content, and now they're selling gardening enthusiast equipment, plants, beds, seeds. And that's the majority of their business going forward. And so they have online commerce, but they're also expanding into retail stores as well. So yeah, we're definitely seeing a change in the market this year, and it's very exciting.
Your massive expectations that what worked in China is going to work here. Mainly, I think in China, it was like these big social media channels that were doing massive amounts of live shopping, not individual retailers. And we tried to, I think, apply that to retail space here, and it didn't work out as expected. Right now, I think TikTok Shop is probably the most well-known live shopping channel. Do you think their growth has helped maybe reinvigorate the sector?
I think it's definitely reinvigorated conversations around the space. And I think something that we've seen over the last couple of years is that there's starting to be some emerging, what we call like infrastructure that supports the live and social commerce industry, where you're seeing companies like Orca or Favored Live or even the Creator Society, where they're working with talent to create shoppable formats and IP and dedicated studio space, and then having unique relationships with these platforms to determine best practices, which is if you're going to create shoppable content or affiliate content, how do you design, how do you develop it, how do you produce it with the right economics, and then what are the right conversion funnels for the product, and then how do you get both retailers and brands involved so that you have a really good, refreshing product supply? Because if you have like one creator or business selling one product over and over, it's going to get stale. It's like if the same YouTube creator or TikTok creator put out the same video every single day, it's just not going to work. So I do think that, plus that TikTok has really leaned into their affiliate platform where they're connecting hundreds of thousands of different creators with retailers and brands and marketers. I think that connection where you're bringing product access to audience and creative minds to again create these like kind of shoppable formats is a really powerful tool that they've built. And I think it's inspiring a lot of others too.
Why aren't other large apps, for example, Amazon tried live shopping and it didn't really work out. Why do you think they weren't as successful?
It's a good question. And I'm not going to say I'm an expert on why it failed on some of these bigger platforms, but I think it always comes down to access to good product, access to a good, call it like live shopping and social commerce environment. So you're not just hosting video, but like what's the discoverability of this content, right? And what are the features that are going to drive engagement and purchase during the stream? And then how do you drive kind of engagement and return behavior before and after the stream as well? It's not just about what's happening during that video. And how are you getting good talent involved with like good ideas and good support teams? And so probably kind of that whole broader ecosystem didn't necessarily exist, and there were some gaps there.
The other thing that I personally saw was like really no differentiation. I mean, you went on their page for live shopping and it was just the same as you saw on Instagram and YouTube or let's say Facebook, and they're all the same. And the expectation was that consumers are going to just run and flock to all of these different sessions. And I think that's probably Probably the biggest assumption that hasn't played out is how that interaction and connection with the consumer, the shopper, actually works here. That is best for the shopper, not what's best for the platform. And I think that's probably where Whatnot has done good, is they're really laser focused on a very specific experience or an audience.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like the value prop has to be very clear to the consumer because they have to think to themselves, why do I want to go to this live or social commerce experience versus going to a retail store, going to a Shopify site, going to a retailer site, ordering somewhere from online. Why do I want to go to this live stream? Because I want to see, like a talent that I'm a fan of. I want to see a content format that feels unique, exciting, fun. I'm learning about the product. I'm engaging with other consumers. We're having like fun. It's exciting. It's keeping me leaned in. Maybe I'm getting access to discounts. There's unique product inventory that I'm not getting anywhere else. So that's driving unique exclusivity. You have to answer that question for the consumer of like, why are they going to come versus, what are the traditional outlets? And then I think like, look, in a world today where there's just so much social media noise and things that are grabbing for your attention, how are you actually marketing this experience and getting the consumer to tell them clearly, like articulate the value prop, why this is going to be exciting for them, why they should join? And so I think that critical marketing that's happening before the stream and before the experience and after to keep them coming back is really, really critical. And it's not easy.
Yeah, that's a good point. How you actually engage your audience. So, in case of Amazon, for example, when I go to the app, I've never seen anything about live shopping sessions. Competition in Amazon is not just from like retailers selling products. It's also from internal Amazon teams trying to get access to the users.
Case in point, I was on Amazon this morning. I'm preparing for a move, and this is not the most probably exciting product for social commerce, but I need things like moving boxes and moving blankets and all that. So as I go on, it's just a bunch of different modules of like medium-sized boxes and large boxes. But if there was some like rich content, and I'm busy, right? So I don't want like a 10-minute explainer video, but if there was like quick 10, 20-second explainers that were like, hey, if you're doing this type of move in this type of place, like these are the things that you're going to need. Here's like a whole curation of everything, everything that you need to buy over the next couple of weeks. That's a different experience. Like you said, Amazon is such a massive, diversified business, and the real estate that they have on their pages has been tested and iterated on before, and they have like very established work streams. So, this is why I think like these big incumbents, when they're doing something experimental, like live and social commerce, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. They have to tell a story internally to the stakeholders and the leaders of like why this makes financial sense, why they need to invest in this versus the 20 other things on their plate. Versus, right, this is the classic kind of philosophy in startups. If you have one company laser focused on a single thing, that's all they're doing, that's how they can stand out.
Let's talk about what is the creator economy.
Yeah, it's a very broad question. This actually came up. I was on a panel at South by Southwest with some like, fellow investors and executives in the space. And we're talking about like, what does it mean to invest in creators? Like, what exactly is that? And I think what I said is like, this is about investing in the next wave of entrepreneurs and business builders around the world. And that you see a variety of different business models that are both consumer facing, that are business facing, and then in the future could even be industrial as well. Who knows, right? So I think in the beginning you're seeing different media brands and lifestyle brands and e-commerce brands emerge from creators. You're also seeing B2B services like production companies and digital advertising agencies and tools. You're actually seeing tooling for different creators and peers. And you're starting to see also like this other consumer brands, like this massive wave of CPG products and e-commerce businesses that are starting to emerge. And it's fun to think about like where does this go, right? Because if creators, a lot of people are now saying, hey, instead of raising in venture capital, really the way to win is telling story about your product and distribution to and get it in front of audiences and consumers. So how do you partner with a creator or an influencer to do that? So the whole paradigm of how you think about building businesses and what are the team members and the advisors that you need is really shifting. So I would say the creator economy Everyone thinks about it as like YouTube and social channel owners. But as you broaden the definition, like I just described, I think the creator economy becomes every single business around the world.
Would it make sense that you would say every business then needs to involve either have their own creative channel or they need to work with other creators?
Yeah, like if you think about any business, every business has to create a product or a service that is solving a problem for a customer. And then they need to drive awareness of that product or service so that they can drive sales. And so I think what we're learning is previously the traditional ways of advertising, of running billboards or running like 30-second commercial spots on TV, those are starting to go by the wayside because you got to go to where the modern consumer is spending their time. And they're spending time on digital and specifically increasingly within social media. And within social media, they're following influencers and talent personalities and social native brands. And so if you want to get in front of a customer, then probably the one of the best and most economical ways to do that is work with a creator or digital native brand that has an affinity with your target audience, knows how to reach them, knows how to speak to them. The called the advertising and user acquisition economics are going to be much better than traditional paid media or traditional advertising. That's where this whole future is headed.
Is this what you are recommending to your clients when you help them plan their go-to-market? What's the mix that you're recommending right now?
Yeah. So I would say the majority of clients that we work with are, call it more like native to the creator space, where these are digital media brands or digital and influencer agencies that are building, building on social media, building on digital platforms, on FAST, on podcasting, and you name it. So a lot of the big decisions that they're thinking about is often, okay, this is where we are today. We want to grow revenue. We want to grow profit. We want to improve margins. We want to make ourselves more attractive to a potential future buyer of our business, right? Because this is where Rockwater really focuses our time. So then they ask us questions, how do we do that? And so we look at what's their content footprint? What are their formats? Where are they distributing content? Maybe they're on TikTok and Instagram, but they're not on YouTube, or they're on YouTube in short form. So it's like, hey, you can really invest and create more content here, reach more audience, add more IP to your portfolio, build more of that audience funnel to do more brand partnerships, sell other consumer products. And we think about what do their customers and what do their audiences want from them? So is there other ways to have like different experiences, whether it's through events or merch or subscription? And then oftentimes, like it's really where we are best at, it's just looking at the fundamentals. Where it's like, hey, you guys are on the right platforms and you're already talking to brands, you're doing partnerships and all these things, but your business model is maybe a little skewed, right? Your rate card is a little off, you're not pricing it right. You're not structuring your deals with your end clients in the appropriate way. So how, or maybe your team is organized or you don't have the right resources to really grow properly. So how do you kind of like rethink what your organizational structure is? And then this allows them to kind of grow, achieve better financial and operational KPIs so that it makes them more viable and attractive for a potential sale. And then that's when we would be tapped in to work with them and advise them on a sales process.
What are your thoughts about generative AI and how it's changing the creator economy?
Broadly, I do believe that AI is going to enhance the workforce and it's going to enhance people's roles and make them better at what they do. That being said, is there going to be friction as we go through this transition? And will people, will some people be out of work? Will there be a lot of retraining needed? 100%. Now, specifically for the creator economy, I think that we're going to, and this is, I think, true for just like, broader entrepreneurs and business building, you're going to see businesses be able to do a lot more with a lot less. So, in terms of being able to produce, develop, edit content, you're going to be able to do that with, there's always improved tooling that's out there. So with less teams, less cost, and you're going to be able to move a lot faster. Same thing with all the administrative in the back end, HR, legal, payment processing, all those tools and all those capabilities are going to get cheaper and you're going to get access to them faster. So I think we're going to see a lot of businesses start to emerge that are going to require a lot less capital. And so they're going to be able to do more and move quickly. So I think that's really exciting for the space because I think the barriers to entry are going to get, are going to become a lot lower. So there's going to be more ideas, more innovation, more experimenting that are going to be emerging into this space. That being said, when you do that, it's going to be harder to stand out. So as a result, companies are really going to have to think about what are we doing that is different from our peers, that is different from our competitors? How are we solving customer problems in unique ways? How are we delighting our audiences with content and experiences and engagement that like no one else is doing? That's going to get harder, but the ones that stand out are going to rise to the top. That's one theme I think about. There's one of our clients and a company that sponsors some of our events, which I think is just awesome, is this company called Linguana. So, one of the biggest challenges for a creator or creator-led business is number one thing that they should be focusing on is really creating content, telling stories, speaking to the audiences. You start to add in all the other things that are involved with running a business, it's really time-consuming and it distracts them from the core of what they do. So all of a sudden, if you have a creator that built this incredible audience and content, and they have a great audience in the US, but they want to expand into other countries, other territories, different languages, and different formats, just the thought of trying to do that can be really intimidating and burdensome. So then you have a solution like Linguana, which is this kind of like AI-powered and enabled dubbing and localization technology that will go and essentially scrape, for lack of a better word, and partner with a creator's content, repackage it, translate it, dub it for another language, and then can distribute it almost instantaneously to a variety of different channels all around the world. And all of a sudden, now your audience reach can be amplified by significantly more. And that audience is your currency for how you transact with advertiser partners to do business deals and strategic partnerships. And there's really, and for that model, there's no capital that's required up front. It's like a 50-50 rev share. That's just like one of many examples. Like, so I think that's really exciting for the space. And one other thing that I saw this on LinkedIn recently, and I don't know the names of the companies, but I'm starting to see like these like AI native publishers where it's literally, I think it's a script, a technology with almost no people behind it, that are doing like the ideating, developing, production, editing, distribution, publishing of content. And then they're driving like recurring revenues from AdSense and programmatic revenues from Snap. And they're generating tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of indirect revenue every single month with maybe like a one-person team, a founder who kicked it off that is now hands-off going forward. That is really, really exciting to think about. And I think we're just seeing the early days of that.
There is a lot of tools. A lot of them are really great, but you need to learn how to use them. It's not like a Gen AI is just going to handle it for you and take care of everything.
Well, and I think also a concern too is I think the platforms are trying to figure out with the proliferation of call it like AI generated content, do they want that on their platforms? How does it sit? How does it stack in the algorithm related to call it just like human generated content? And they're trying to figure out like what are the right moderation policies. So this is really important for different publishers to think of because if you're putting out like purely AI powered content and that's getting deprioritized by the LinkedIn algorithm, by the Facebook algorithm, you got to adjust your business model and your content strategy to adapt for that. I think the idea of getting like more content volume out there is exciting, but there's all these nuances to think about. And for us, while we advise a lot of content businesses, we are also a content business ourselves, right? Like we put out videos, we put out editorial on our website, on LinkedIn. And so for our chain, like our content supply chain, I'm constantly thinking about like what makes the most sense for us. So I use an offshore resource in the Philippines, an individual that does like the editing for our videos, and we have really good systems with him. And then I know that he's also using AI tools to make his, what he does faster and more economical for us as a client. But because I care about the quality of content so much, and I just also want to ensure that it's consistent with our brand, that he'll send me edits, and then I feel like I always have to give a little bit of feedback. Now the feedback is decreasing over time, but I still think that final human QA layer is still critical. Maybe that's also a function of me being a micromanager as a business owner, so maybe I'll change that over time. But I again, to your point, like I think this is as a tool that we have to figure out how we work together versus just solely relying on it.
Every business, every brand has a personality, Right. And you can't just like fake that. You and that's typically when you have a newer company or the company that the founder is still leading, the personality of the founder is in there. And that is a part of the uniqueness of it. That's why, they have an audience. So I think that's the part that like when you have other people, there is always going to be that feedback. Yeah, I can imagine that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite deals in recent months.
So I think it's helpful to step back a bit and kind of just like frame the scene, right? So I think as I mentioned, over the past couple of years, call it like 22 to 24, there's a bit of downturn in called deal making and investing in the creator economy. I think, like I said, there was a lot of companies that built solutions in searches of problems, and that's not a good way to build a business. Bloated OpEx, no focus on profitability, determined it was really challenging UA economics, hard to kind of scale some of these businesses. So what we saw is like the bottom 80% of companies built in the space face a lot of challenges. Fire sales, consolidation, shutdowns, bankruptcies, you name it. That being said, Darius, because the macro tailwinds in this space of more people spending time on digital, specifically within social, revenue then follows consumer behavior. So we saw a lot increased spend in social influencer marketing, and then capital follows revenue. So there were still landmark deals that happened over the past couple of years. We saw large YouTube channel businesses, large digital aggregators like Electrify raising large amounts of money to invest. We saw Theorist Media selling to Lunar X. We saw large digital agencies like Influential selling to Publicis for 500 million. One of our clients, Oxford Road, sold to Insignia Capital and combined with Veritone One. And so we saw like the top 20% of builders in the space who built viable business models, growing revenue, focus on profitability, differentiated value prop, that there was still a lot of deal making because of this kind of like these like macro tailwinds behind the creator space. Now, I think in 2025, it feels like we're entering a new growth cycle. And I think just from like the deals that we're seeing at the end of last year and in the first quarter of 2025, we're seeing a lot more capital, a lot more buyouts happen. And in addition, in the M&A processes that we're running, we're seeing kind of like what we would call like non-traditional buyers start to enter the space and look at deals. Because they look at content, like you said, as a new way to acquire customers more efficiently. We saw this in the Wonder and Tastemade deal. Wonder is a food services business that bought Tastemade, a food publisher, for 90 million, around one, roughly what we estimate around 1x revenue. We're also running an M&A process for a food publisher right now, and we're not just seeing digital media companies and digital agencies look at it from a buy side perspective. We're also seeing retailers that are looking at this company as how can it enhance their shopper marketing for peer CPG brands. So, like the categories where we're seeing a lot of activity is YouTube channel owners, social publishers, talent representation companies, influencer agencies, podcasting, and social commerce and social native CPG. These are categories that are getting a lot of attention from buyers. We're seeing more capital flows. And yeah, like you're seeing landmark deals. So, just to call out a few in the digital ad agency space, Publicis bought Influential last year. But then recently, they bought the same business model, BR Media, in Latin America, based out of Brazil. And then you're seeing also these challenger ad networks like Sammy Alliance acquire a bunch of digital agencies. Brave Bison just bought one out of the UK. Stagwell, Acceleration Group of companies, they're starting to just roll up a lot of these different digital agency businesses. And that consolidation M&A activity is going to keep persisting. On the talent representation, starting, just still, there's a lot of deals that we've written about. I think we wrote about 20 deals like since 2022. But like the deals persist. We just saw Carlyle buy a minority stake in Entertainment 360, a large traditional management company. CoralTree bought a minority stake in Innovative Artists. And then we saw, last year, one of our clients, Bottle Rocket Management, sold to Knight. And then we also saw another client of ours, Long Haul Management. They sold to Wasserman, a global sports and talent agency. In the social commerce space and influencer marketing as well, we sold Bounty, call it like a branded UGC platform that sold to Gen.Video. So, these are some of the deals that stand out to me in the categories where we're seeing some really, really exciting activity. And then I'll close it out with, direct investment that's happening into YouTube channels. So we saw Highmount Capital do a direct investment. I think they bought around a 60% share in Dude Perfect. And then we saw Good Good Golf, like a modern lifestyle and sports brand. They just raised $45 million from, I think, Creator Sports Capital. And then Epic Gardening, which raised like $18 million from TCG a few years ago, they bought three different agricultural and kind of like farming related media and product businesses recently. And they just bought Modern Farmer, which was announced a couple months ago. So I think the investment and acquisition into these YouTube and social native publishers is something that is increasingly happening and we're going to see a lot more of going forward. You're seeing all these new businesses emerge where people who are experts at teaching languages or teaching Excel or in art and design, where previously they might have to go become a teacher, or that's just like a side hobby that they do for fun and then they get a W-2 job. All of a sudden now they can be super niche, super focused, and then create content that builds like a small following. And then through brand partnerships, affiliate revenues, through subscriptions powered by Kajabi or Skillshare. Now there's so many different ways for them to make money off of their expertise and their passion. And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, what's happening with AI? It's like what's happened with the printing press and the Industrial Revolution. Whenever our overall economy goes through a transformative shift, there's going to be friction and pain, but there's also going to be incredible opportunity. And that's how I believe about kind of AI in the creator economy space.
What do you think about ChatGPT and the experience and how very large numbers of people are going there every single day? I don't go to search anymore. I don't have time. I just go to here. I start my search a lot of times on ChatGPT. How is that going to update the content business?
Yeah, I mean, I look at ChatGPT as an incredible tool that I'm now using for almost every single thing in my life. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's part of when you think about the AI and the tooling for creators, I think it falls in the same bucket of you need content inspiration, you need scripting, you need image generation, cheaper animation, you need access to legal contracts because you're doing a licensing agreement or you're hiring a new member of your team. Previously, like you'd have to have law firms and accounts and do all these things. And now these AI tools are making that super easy and more accessible, right? That's the future. But yeah, for us, we use it for everything, right? If I'm researching, if we have to keep our own database for M&A comps in the space, we have our own network of buyers of companies that we think are, relevant targets and why. And all the insights from the executive conversations that we have from all of my day-to-day meetings, all of our events, all of our newsletters. But like if I want to go on and get a quick synopsis of a business and its peers in the industry and how it stands out and who other buyers are, I can do that really quickly on ChatGPT. So it's awesome. And I think the main theme is people, what I'm observing from my peers is there's all these new use cases that are starting to emerge that they're then educating their peers on. And that's really exciting. One of the things that I'm doing is like I'm negotiating with vendors for a wedding that I have coming up in like 4 to 5 months. I know how to read contracts, I'm business trained and all that fun stuff, but it's time consuming. Now I could just upload that contract into ChatGPT and say, hey, are these terms like indemnification, usage rights, are these market aligned? Are these fair? What is standard? And then give me an email that I can send back to the vendor that makes my points. And that happens in 2 seconds. I was speaking to someone else that I knew that like had to figure out a way to split a utility bill with their roommates. And they're like, oh, just upload it into ChatGPT and tell them the problem and boom, there you go. Right. So I think like, and it's just funny to talk about that because this is kind of like the more day-to-day quotidian stuff. But I think it just goes to show that you're right. Like, I'm not going to Google anymore. I'm just going on my phone on ChatGPT and I'm asking it questions. And it's coming back to me either in written format or in voice. I even had another one of our clients is negotiating with investors for an initial investment round. He was on a drive home from something for 45 minutes. So he just put on the chat function on ChatGPT and said, hey, role play with me. You're the investor. I'm the company raising funds. This is them, how much we want to raise at these valuation terms. Now let's go back and forth, like over a phone call and negotiation. And then did that through like three or four different simulations. So, I mean, I think about like the power of ChatGPT from, identifying buyers of a company to fundraising, to negotiating terms, to legal contracts, to script development, to how you hire people. It's just there's so many use cases that we can talk about and we know now, and so many more that we don't even know yet. And I think that's awesome.
Going back to the YouTube experience, for example, right now we go to YouTube and we are looking for I don't know how to build a new deck for my house. And you get a whole bunch of videos. But if I'm going to ChatGPT now and asking that question, am I taking business away from YouTube, or is ChatGPT going to work with YouTube and actually because it's starting to show videos from YouTube in the results?
I think you're raising big questions, right? There's some that I know of and some that I don't even know of. But I think one is all of these AI applications, they need access to massive, large databases of information to train their language learning models, right? So now you're starting to see deals happen where there's licensing deals with Reddit, probably lots of active conversations with the large social media platforms and others. And then, it's thinking about like what is the user journey going to look like? So, I think a big thing that's happening is a lot of people are just going right to ChatGPT or whatever the interface that they use versus like Google.com. But I mean, is now that portal, maybe that's a starting point for the customer conversation, but the data that's powering it, the like, the sourcing links, the referral videos, which is like, all right, you want to do like a, you want to revamp the deck of your home. Here's four videos that you want to watch from YouTube, and like, here's why. And then it now takes you to those videos. So that's like better discoverability, which could then power a lot of these, power YouTube, power Snap, power TikTok. And increasingly, I think a lot of those platforms are start integrating AI into their search and discoverability. So it becomes more personalized and you can find the content and your peer group and your community a lot faster in a more targeted way, which is going to drive more viewership, more retention, more time spent on platform, which is better for advertising. How all this shakes out and when, it's too early to tell, but it's going to be exciting.
For an M&A deal, walk me through what are the early conversations, how does it start from the company side, and then how do you help them?
So I get inbounds from companies, founders, investors every day through our newsletter, through our events, through my email and inbox, my LinkedIn DMs. And I think one of the challenges that we face on in Rockwater is there's only so many hours in a day, and there's only so many companies that we can advise. So a big thing that I have to do is I have to qualify businesses to make sure that they are a good fit for us. And I wish I could work with everyone. I just, unfortunately, I can't because I just love supporting entrepreneurs and builders and all that. So the way that we typically work is I spend time getting to know the company and understand like what is their viability for a sale. Would they be attractive to the buyers that are in our network, knowing what they're looking for and all of that? So we look at their financials, their operating KPIs, their team quality, what are their growth plans, what are their sell side expectations? And most of the times I have to say, no, you're not, you're too early stage or you're not a fit for what we do. We're very, very focused. So we're focused as sell side advisors for the creator economy digital agencies. If you're outside of that, we can't work with you, except in rare cases. And then, like sometimes if we feel a company is a really good fit, we'll then engage in an M&A process, which I'll talk about in a moment. If we feel like, hey, you guys could be a good fit for us, but you're still not 100% sure that you want to sell, maybe let's start with an M&A diagnostic. Let's do a valuation of your business. We'll clean up your financials for how a buyer would look at it. We'll understand what are the growth trends, the margins, the KPIs. And then we'll look at precedent transactions in the space. And understand here's your valuation in the market today. In addition, we'll make some recommendations to your business based on what your peers are doing and what buyers are valuing. So it's like, hey, here are three low lift, high impact things that you could do over the next 6 to 12 months that makes you more attractive for a sales process. Then we have a database conversation with the client of, based on these learnings, do you want to go to market now or do you want to go to market in the future? Right. And we determine what's best for the client. And that's a collaborative conversation. If it is determined that they want to sell, Then the way that we run a process is we spend, a couple months doing creating marketing collateral for the business, so creating an overview deck that explains their business model, where they see growth opportunities, what is their unique positioning in the market, how they could combine with a buyer and grow and grow faster. We then also create like updated financials and a forecast and clean them up, like I said, for how a buyer would look at it. And then we create a targeted buyers list. So we have access through our CRM of thousands of different relationships. And then we tailor those relationships based on who we think is a good fit for that business. And then we do some additional research. And then after a couple, we'll call it a couple months where we have all the marketing materials and the data room and everything prepped, we then go to market and it's called the marketing process. So now we're doing outreach to these hundreds and thousands of buyers within our network. We're going to qualify them, see if they're interested in wanting to buy our client. And we do this all anonymously. They have to first sign an NDA. And then we ask them, to bid, get an initial indication of interest. Based on the bids that we receive, if we feel that they are achieving the client's goals and we feel that they're real within the valuation range that is compelling and they're financed and they have a mandate to do a deal from leadership and they're not just kicking the tires, we allow them to gain access to an additional round to get more diligence, data room, all that. And then invite them to submit, call it like a second and final round bid. We pick the buyer who's best fit for our clients, and then we work to negotiate the best deal, do confirmatory diligence to close. So that process can run anywhere from around like 4 to, call it like 4 to 6 months. But there's things that we can control in the process, and there's things that we can't control, right? Like macro market volatility, tariffs, things happening to the buyers, whatever, right? So we've done deals in 3 to 4 months, and then we've also done deals that have taken 15 months. So our value prop to our clients is we know these business models better than anyone else. We know what is valuable about your business to buyers. We have more relationships in this space with the executives and capital allocators that are doing these types of deals than any other peer that's out there. We have systems to best market and position you to get in front of these decision makers faster and smarter than anyone else and get you the best result. We will never guarantee an outcome, but we will make sure that we run the most effective process to optimize a potential result for your business. And then at the end of the day, if you get a deal that you like, you can take it. And if you don't like the deal, you can always walk away.
That's
That's how we work.
a pretty big investment on your side, on your end. So that I understand why you need to qualify really carefully up front.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, so you nailed it, Darius. I have to be very selective about who we work with because we take a small retainer up front, which we make no money off of that. It's really just like paying for the team for the next 2 to 3 months. So that's why if we're going to take a client on, we have to believe in their business, make sure that their goals make sense to market, and we're going to be spending a lot of time together over the next 6, 12 months, and hopefully we get a great result.
Thank you so much, Chris.
That's a wrap for this episode of Retail Tech Podcasts. If you enjoyed the conversation, take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps others discover the show. For more insights, resources, and episode details, visit retailtechpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Also, remember to check out and support our sponsor, Visional. Redefining local e-commerce with hybrid AI and human-powered shopping, helping shoppers buy from local stores and retailers capture more sales. See how it works at getvisional.com.